everybody. Time for another edition of Health Talks with Dr. Trin. The one show, the only show that shows you a path to healthier living. Sometimes it starts with the past. Sometimes you got to put things aside before you can move on. I think that's what we're going to talk about today, right, Dr. Trin?
Yes, yes. And I am excited to bring Shasheen Shah back to chat further about his book, The Kid and the King. We want to break down into more details today on what this is about, maybe some highlight bullet points on what's behind this book and what the teaching points are.
So let's start with just giving us a wrap up of the book again, Shasheen, and your story. And then I'm going to drop out because I'm suffering from kind of a health talks and I'm not feeling very healthy. I got some kind of flu developing. So I'm going to kind of drop out here. So no statement about what you're doing here. I'm just going to listen today like everybody else. But start by reminding everybody who you are and what you did.
I love it, Paul. And I'm sorry you're not feeling well. And I love the fact that we're kicking it off with some self-care for you.
It's all about me.
This book is truly about taking self-care to the next level. I mean, it really is. I think that it's about developing greater compassion and love with yourself so that you can actually go out and make an impact in the world. And it came to me in my own journey and looking at the challenges that myself, really successful people, clients, my family, friends, my community were suffering from at the hands of various addictions, just triggers, just broken relationships. There was just a lot going on. The book could have been called Why Do Really Smart People Do Dumb Things? And why is it that we can be so smart, that go to such incredible schools, have such incredible background resources in front of us, and yet we don't take action on them and we carry on our lives in a way that's really not consistent with the intellect, with the intention, with the person that we want to be in the world. So that's what the book looks into, and it goes deep. Yeah.
Wow. So tell us, is it a book about mindset? Is the problem a problem of mindset? Or is the problem the problem of outside of mindset? Like why we do dumb things? Or why do we don't take advantage of, I don't know, of our potential?
Right. Or like, it's funny, the other day I was doing an interview and it was almost like this conversation of like, I want to start a podcast called The Amazing Grasp of the Obvious, stuff that you already know that's right in front of you that you haven't taken action on. And the wisdom is all there, right? So is it mindset? I think so. I think there's some really good mindset people out there. I propose in the book that what there is confusion about what it is to be human, right? And so what does that mean? I think that what I experienced as a young man growing up was confusion. How was it that I could be with such sincere and good intention to go out there in the world and do things and to succeed and to grow and develop myself, still engage in behaviors like procrastination or self-sabotage? And where did that live inside of me? What was going on there? And then I realized I wasn't alone. I mean, I'm talking to now as an adult and the privilege I've had and the lens I've had into the world of some of the most extraordinary men and women. I look at them and I ask myself the same question. It's like, you went to Harvard, you went to Stanford, you have a PhD and you can't make this call on time, or you can't lose weight, or you can't seem to let go of this anger or this frustration or whatever it might be. And I think that the confusion stems from this idea that we are uncomfortable being uncomfortable. And when we become uncomfortable, what we try to do is fix it. We solve it. We crush it. We conquer it. We overcome it. We suck it up. We get a coach. We get a tutor. We get a mentor. We get something to fix this part of ourselves with, I think, a false, and I don't know if it's actually sold to us this way, but there is a presumptive nature to that pursuit, as if somehow, someday, with enough time, with enough coaches, with enough money, I'll be able to put that part of me on mute. I will be able to turn it off and have it be done. And I haven't seen that work yet. So that's what the book is about, is rather than fighting that side of us, is to understand this part of us, which I call the kid in the book, become so familiar with this part of ourselves that we know and we understand the circumstances, the situations, the kinds of things that will bring up this part of our psyche that will get triggered, that will take us out of our quote unquote king or queen state, our highest and best version of ourselves, and derail us from pursuing our dreams and our goals. And so that's what the book looks at. So there is a mindset to it. Yeah.
Interesting. So the ideal state is not to become the king, but to become the kid.
I would say that the ideal state would be is to recognize and become familiar as a king, which I juxtapose with the kid, in that the king is coming from an outcome-driven place. The king is standing there looking at the world and saying, wow, what do I want? How can I contribute to the world? What serves me, others, and the greater good? Now, in the pursuit of our dreams, in the pursuit of our goals, in the pursuit of something new, whatever it might be, what happens is instinctually, and you know, you're the doc in the room here, you can tell us, right, about the limbic system, how we're hardwired, how our entire system is based on protecting us from threats that exist out there. And so we don't live in a world that we have to really worry about physical survivability, although we can make that argument today in 2021 as we go into 2022. Yes. But the truth is, most of these things come from this desire to emotionally survive. We're just not wanting to go revisit those experiences of our childhood and feel insecure. We don't want to feel left out. We want to be seen. We want to be included. Right. And when you get down to it, drives and motivates some of the most successful people in the world. Even those who are claiming that it's for the greater good, there's still an element of them wanting to be seen. They want to be recognized. They want to be loved. And that, to put that and understand that in context as a human being, and really understand where your motivations are coming from, and then see others through that lens, it gives you a lot of power to navigate the world a lot more elegantly than having to kick and fight and prove and show everybody how smart you are.
That's fascinating. Tell us more about the limbic system, the amygdala, the parts of the brain whose only goal is self-protection. Tell us more about that. Does that limbic system, is that what limits us from our potential? By it overreacting or overdoing its job so that you don't break beyond those barriers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a qualified doc or psychologist in this conversation, but what I can tell you in my experience, my understanding of it is there is a physical response. And I know that only because I can feel my blood start to boil. I can feel my heart rate start to go up. I can feel my voice start to increase in its volume. I start to speak faster. Mm-hmm. There's something that actually happens, and it's almost like it's a cliff that you end up falling off. And, you know, and from my reading, and I've heard people call it, we get hijacked. We see something and we look at it as if that is going to threaten us in some way. And we have these intense emotional reactions. And so how does this play out in our life? If you raised your hand in school and you got made fun of, it's interesting that you're not going to raise your hand again. You're going to really have to come up against raising your hand again. And we're taught that in that example, for example, right? It's not really accurate to say, gosh, every single time I raise my hand, I'm going to get made fun of and I'm going to feel badly. Now, a useful version of that can be if I stick my finger in a socket or I touch a hot flame and I get electrocuted. My brain says, that's danger. Don't do that again, Shashin. And hopefully we learn from that.
Yes.
So I think the mechanism that's there works in certain instances, and in other instances, it can really hold us back.
I really like that analogy because we work 90% of the time in our subconscious, right? The decisions we make are emotionally driven subconscious decisions that may derive from an early childhood experience, such as how many of us remember being in third grade, raising our hand and getting the wrong answer, and feeling really small, right? And although we don't remember that event in third grade, that may have been embedded in our subconscious that if we volunteer, if we step out, if we try to give an answer, we may get hurt emotionally.
Right.
And as an adult, right, we may not want to raise our hand for life's opportunities. And we don't remember that third grade experience, but it's embedded.
That's right. And you're touching on, I think, the most important aspect of this, because my clients and the people that I work with, these are big, successful people. And we start going like, we're going to go there. We're going to go to our childhood traumas. We're going to go to mommy and daddy issues. Really? That was where we're going, Shasheen. And what they'll say is like, dude, that was a long time ago. Listen, I've already paid enough therapists. I've sat on the therapist chair. I've talked to, listen, I got it. I'm like, trust me, I think there's probably something there. And I think you're touching on probably the most crucial thing. And that is this idea that, well, that was a long time ago, like time heals. And I don't think that that's true. I think time creates distance between the immediacy of the impact of what happened. But like, I think you're so, what you pointed out was spot on. And that is, it just sits there like a landmine. And you're right. Our five senses are picking up data constantly. And what is it doing with that data? Well, it's filtering it, interpreting it in order for us to understand and make sense of the world. Well, how is it making sense? Well, it's looking back in our historical record and archives of, oh, that's a dog. That dog, well, a dog bit me before. Oh my, I'm a little nervous now, you know, or this person, this. So the conditioning of our lives is where I say, and I believe, and many others have said, I think is the great opportunity for us to kind of take apart and put back together what isn't working. And some of these knee-jerk responses that we're having, our anger, our emotional outbursts, are things that are basically taking us out of emotional states that are, we don't become resourceful people if we're constantly triggered. It's kind of out.
Absolutely. We got some comments here on Facebook. Zach says meditation and breathing exercises to calm the system works wonder in the moment. The key to learning to be comfortable is with uncomfortable.
There's that.
Ooh, I like that. Where did,
that's my buddy, Michael. He is amazing. He's got a great story. If you ever get a chance to look, so just look up, pause, breathe, and reflect. He's an amazing human being. He's been through a ton. And it's a PBR. You got to have your PBR, you know?
Right. So it makes me wonder, why do people have favorite colors? Like, why is your favorite color blue and my favorite color is purple and somebody else's favorite color red? I wonder if the reason we have favorite colors is because of this subconscious experience when we're younger, where the color was linked to either something positive or something negative. I'm curious, why do we have favorite colors?
You know, again, above my pay grade on the psychological front, but I would argue, I mean, just based on my experience, there's usually a trace of something, right? So the work that I do with my clients is to simply say, look, I think that everything that you're experiencing as an adult, we're going to map. We're just going to map. We're going to try to figure out, right? People are looking to take, to advance to this next level, to be more, to do more, to experience life at a different level. So if we see something that's standing in the way, a pattern, some belief, some something, we can really just start to look at like, okay, so tell me, when was the first time you felt that? What do you have associated? And you can, it's an uncanny how simplistic some of this stuff is. It's just like, oh, that happened when I was 10. And now you're 50, and it's still going on.
Yes. And to understand that link is the first step to making a breakthrough.
Agreed.
New changes, right? Is that what you do with your clients? Do you help them to understand the link? Do you walk them through their experiences and their life and things of that sort?
Yeah, 100%. And it's not like with, like, again, I want to make sure that people hear this. And that is the breakthrough, I say, that's the most important breakthrough is to connect the dots. And once you understand that the dots are connected, is to spend time continually understanding and meeting with that pattern response when it comes up, with some compassion for yourself and an understanding of, that's why this keeps going on for me. This is part of the story that I'm dragging from my childhood into my adult self. And here's the key. It's not going away. It's going to be there. And so the argument that I will make with my clients is like, look, if your expectation is I'm going to get rid of that for you, right, it's not going to happen. But what I can do is make you so familiar with it that when you see it, you'll not only, if you're in it, you'll recognize it as such. And rather than trying to crush it, you're just like, oh, pause, breathe, reflect. I got this. It's okay. The king can step up. The kid just wanted to take the wheel. Don't need that. Or even better, you can anticipate it. You know, it's like home run hitters can hit the ball so well because they see the pattern on the stitching of the ball as it's being released from the pitcher's hand. They see it coming right that soon in the, I mean, think how fast these pitches are coming, 90 plus miles an hour.
Yep.
Right? And so what allows them to do it? They see the pattern. So now as I become more familiar with the fact that I'm an Indian immigrant's son and grew up in a particular way and I don't belong and the kids made fun of me because it smelled like curry and all this stuff in my childhood, I'm so familiar with it.
Right.
I so know that my story is I don't belong. I'm not smart enough. They're not going to like me. They're better looking, smarter, richer, whatever, whatever it is.
Right.
I know when I walk into situations where there is someone that may have more money than me, that might have more influence than I have, that may have a higher education than I have. What is predictable for me, what I can see coming, is the kid going, they're going to make fun. And what it'll do is we'll kick in this overcompensation response inside of me. That's not who I am. It's a fear-driven response. And I think that the sad reality for so many of us out there that go through this is that we kind of just put on these masks and we go through life and we kind of get away with it. And we just kind of keep, you know, kind of put, you know, muscle through these situations. Well, all right, I'm good, right? And it's so destructive to our identities as people, because what we're saying in that moment is we're going to subscribe to this pattern. We're opting into this game rather than, oh my gosh, little Bobby, oh, of course you're going to go that way.
Right.
That's not how this is right now.
And what I've learned is we don't have to listen to what our mind tells us. We don't have to listen to what our mind tells us. Right? And because our mind could be telling us, you know, false stuff, as most of our minds do, because our reality is warped based on our life experiences, and it's embedded that as the truth. And so what our mind tells us could obviously not be the truth, right? And to understand that we don't have to listen to what our mind tells us, and to kind of like the Matrix, to step outside of that and get unplugged.
That's right. And I think your brain, this, like, I think that's the other really important part of The Kid and the King, is this idea that we're going to change our relationship to that voice in the head. Right. So the goal is that as it's starting to talk, my relationship to it's like, oh, I recognize you. And again, is there a kid and a king in my psyche? I don't know. Is that true? I don't know. But for me, the idea of breaking up my brain into these two distinct parts was helpful.
Wow.
In understanding, like, oh, that's that fear-driven response. I'm like engaged in thoughts and beliefs about paranoid fantasies about people not liking me, not wanting to be a part of this and that. Whew, that must be the kid.
Yeah, right? Versus, you realize that I'm not the center of the universe. Not correct. Everyone's thinking about me.
There you go. Right.
And so.
And isn't that like a kid, right? Isn't that like a kid? The narcissism of a young kid, like me. What about me? Right. So as adults, if you really take the time, and Zach in the meditation, same thing, right? It's like when you stop to just sit in silence for 10 minutes, even. And meet what goes on between these two ears can be one of the most confronting moments of a person's life. and is really uncomfortable. And every meditation teacher will tell you is that, you need to be the observer of these thoughts. Right. Visualize the champagne bubbles floating to the top and thrusting. See the visual screen on the, you know, like, wait, they'll teach you those things. Why? Because they want to tell you, they want to help you understand that you are not that voice, but you are the observer of that voice. And yeah, we get into that and you know, a whole world opens.
Let me tell you something really interesting, and it relates to your book here with the kid and the king and this inner voice that we don't have to listen to. So and I don't know how it is in your community coming from India, but I think it's going to be very similar to the Asian community in academics, right? In academics. Ever heard of the word tiger moms? Right? You kind of grew up in that world, right?
Yeah.
And so in the Southeast Asian community, your grades in school reflects who you are.
Yeah.
And that's embedded in by a culture that says to be successful, you need A's in your classes, right? To be successful. And then your parents push it on you. And because our parents are successful parents, you know, that did well because their parents pushed on those grades and education. And I'm not saying we shouldn't promote education and good grades, but what eventually happens is this: our self-worth is tied to a grade. I have a lot of friends who went to med school, John Hopkins, right, top med schools, straight A's, UC Irvine, UCLA, straight A's with low self-esteem, because when they get that B, they feel worthless. And that's where these childhood experiences, even as grades are pushed upon you, second grade, third grade, why'd you get that B? An A minus is an Asian F, right? And so we have psychologically embed that voice that is telling us falsehood, that you are not your grades. And the truth is you're not a grade, but we don't grow up that way. So that's a misconnect of why a lot of folks may be very successful financially, educationally, and yet live life with low self-esteem, never feeling happy or feeling worth it for who they are, right? It's that, and to recognize that and to take yourself outside of that and to recognize that link that has always been pushed on you is very important, because now you can break free of those connections.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the lens that I have into when people find me, they're at the top of their game in a lot of ways. I mean, they have succeeded.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I typically will see is on paper and on the surface, I mean, it's just really admirable and enviable. I mean, it really is. I mean, in the way in which their abilities to achieve, their abilities to succeed, their abilities to create great things, to do great things, to invent great things, to build great things, to start great things, it's phenomenal. And the sadness for me as somebody that went through, you know, I got a 99 on my exam. My dad asked me what I got wrong. That was right there in that heart of that conversation. And again, these are not malintended people. They're just like, you got to learn from your mistakes. That's how you grow up. But you find people feeling very alone, feeling very misunderstood. And to me, I think at the end of the day, it's the quality of the relationships that you have in life that makes life worth living. Emotional intimacy is not possible if you're too busy being a good boy or a good girl or just pushing people away. When you're having to live with this sense of like confusion, I would argue, there's this thing that you keep squashing down every day. And I would argue that those that have made it in that way by squashing it down do end up feeling like, now look, is that for everybody? No.
No.
But at least the people that I've had the chance to work with and people in my community and observing some of the things, you see where there's cracks in the armor. You see the addictions, you see the divorces, you see the drinking and the alcoholism, you see the pills, you see the behavior, the materialism, the lack of kindness in some people.
Right.
And you just got to wonder, like, okay, so the book for me truly is about what I say is the most important thing And that is constituting yourself as an emotionally generous person in the world. Like, what does that even mean?
Right.
Like, are you capable of being emotionally generous? If you've been squashing that stuff down, if you've been living with that insecurity, if you've been overcompensating in your whole life, it's really tough. It's hard to let your parents off the hook. It's hard to let the people in your office off the hook. Those who don't have that suck it up, focus, discipline, get it together, man. That's what I did. You should do it too. The number one thing I deal with in the organizations that I work with are extraordinarily bright, talented individual achievers. They are like, give me the ball. I'm going to run.
Yes.
But you have them now in charge of a department. You have them in charge of a group of people. You want to talk about just a disaster waiting to happen.
Wow.
Because they don't have the empathy skills. They don't understand why these other people's needs, wants, and desires aren't being squashed just like they had to. So there's no compassion. There's no understanding. And now we've dubbed this entire generation of sensitive millennials, right? Because we just don't get them. I mean, you know, there's always a bit of truth in everything, but that's it. Asking yourself, like, you know, and it's interesting, right? I wrote this book. Why? Because I needed it the most for me. I wish my 16-year-old kid, myself at 16, could have read this.
Right.
Because I've had to go through life like judging and pushing people away and protecting myself against others and outsiders and, you know, or overcompensating and trying to be a good boy and do you like me? And it's just exhausting. And so if you can get this inner game sorted out or start just the inquiry into the inner game while you're going out there and conquering the world.
Right.
Do both. Just bring some of this into the equation. And I think you're going to find just life's experience is just a lot better. And gosh, you're the doc. I mean, you know what this looks like in the body. What happens when this anger lives there, when all of this anxiety lives there, when the stress lives there, when every single day is just toughing it out. That's just...
It eats you up.
There you go. You heard it.
And it leads to a poor immune system. It leads to health conditions. It's, you know, in the United States, one of the most highly prescribed medication in a country that is considered one of the most successful country in the world, financially and things of that sort. One of the most prescribed medication is an antidepressant.
There you go. That's I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah. And I'm glad that the doc has brought that up because, I mean, I think we're just uncomfortable with being uncomfortable. And rather than take on and do, you know, my clients would be like, God, Shashina, I really got to write this letter. Do I really got to do this stuff? Do I really got to do this stuff? Do I really? And again, by the way, it's all in the book. I mean, it's all right in here. If you want the playbook, it's right here. And I'm like, you don't have to. But if you do, you might be able to get some facility over this. Like, yeah, but it's harder. I'm feeling like doing it. I'm like, isn't it hard doing it the way you're doing it right now? So instead of dealing with that, what have we done? We've medicated ourselves. And trust me, forget medication, distraction with alcohol, drugs, pornography. I mean, material stuff, anything that we can. Our phones, my God, the notifications are like ding, 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 ding. You know, I forgot to turn it off. And it's like, presence. You know, Zach, where's our meditation buddy, right? You know, like, let's get into silence. And it can, it's, look. I mean, without sounding like some like Pollyanna about this whole thing is, look, there's practical reality and you got to get things done and there's teamwork, you know, there's just things you got to do. You got a wife, you got kids, you got a husband, you got family members, you got to take care of things. But let's just say you're busy 7 days a week. Try being busy 6 days a week. If you're busy 5 days a week, try doing it 4.5 days a week. If you're busy, right, just get up 20 minutes earlier, go take a walk, do something, move your body. There's just so much wisdom out there that's already, you don't need a coach, you don't need any. Just
turn off
towards some of that and you'll see that you start feeling better. And that's honestly what I've become addicted to is the fact that from going plant-based now to my exercise routine to my spiritual practices without no more alcohol in my system, no more anything that's messing with coffee and caffeine is the only thing. Why? Because I just feel better.
Mm.
I know what it looks like on the other side, and it's just a lot of work. And maybe I'm just weak. I don't know. I mean, I used to wear a badge of honor, but I could drink all night and get out there and crush it. Yeah, okay. But I've done that, though. I've already played that game, and right. I've won that game to some degree. But, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, what I've noticed and what you mentioned really kind of struck me in that you got a 99, and Dad said, what did you get wrong, right? And I've noticed many, many people around us, including myself, we have thoughts, we have ideas, we have projects that we think would change the world, and they never get launched because they remain in here. They never get launched. And they never get launched because we are afraid of getting that 1% wrong. We're looking for perfect rather than done. And so we never take that next step to improve on our life, our career, whatever that next step is, right? Because of that fear of failure, that fear of 1% of what did you get wrong?
Yeah.
That was embedded in our minds. And that fear is that inner voice that is not connected with the truth, but we believe it because it was part of our childhood. It was ingrained in us that failure is bad. Yeah. Right? Getting that 1% wrong is bad. Any type of failure is bad. Any type of failure is tied to our self-worth. Yeah. And as a result of that, because we don't want to drag down our self-worth, we don't want to risk making that 1% mistake. So nothing ever moves on or gets launched.
Yeah. And it took me 6 years to get this book off. And it's amazing to me that this is literally my playbook. I told the last guy that helped me, organize. I had to tear the whole thing up during COVID. I just started from scratch again.
Wow.
And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, this is so unbelievably frustrating. It's like, I speak this book out every day to my clients. This is not some theoretical, it's not some creative project. I mean, this is what I do every day. I say these things every single day. And I had to start from scratch. And this book for me,
right,
was my journey of meeting that part of me that wanted to, I wasn't even so afraid that it's like, it didn't have to be a massive success, but it's just what I was most worried about. It was just irrelevant. Like no one cared. And I was like, everything had to be, it's just the internal conversation,
right,
that I had to meet. And I had to have a chat with my kid. I had to write another letter to my kid, talk to him about the fact. I had to actually show up to this book.
Wow.
During COVID in a way that I've never had to show up before. Oh, I'll let the editor do it. Oh, I'll let that other person do it. No, like I got to own this. But here's the thing. I really believe that our biggest fear is, what if we did everything we were supposed to and did it the way it was intended to be done, and it still wasn't good enough?
Ooh.
Then what would that say about us?
What if we did succeed and we arrived? We
did everything our moms told us, and we studied, yeah, our time, we did, and we still sucked. Or no, we had an A-. Asian F, I love that. Oh.
Right? Being at the top is lonely, being at the top is lonely. You get your grades, you look around and you're, okay, what's next, right? And so I don't feel fulfilled, right? Yeah, absolutely right. Maybe it's a subconscious thing why we always, maybe we throw our own obstacles in our path because of that fear.
Oh, I mean, there's, I'll take people on, if you've lasted this long in our conversation, you're one of us, which is great. On page 11 in the book, I take people through this simple exercise, and it's just basically to write, and it was with a therapist, and she's like, well, write down your 5 attributes that you're most proud of in yourself, and then 5 attributes that you figure that you could, if I got rid of those, life would be better. And so I wrote down, I'm gregarious, I'm compassionate, I'm aware of others' needs, I'm intelligent, I'm strategic, and I'm loving. That's what I thought about myself at that time.
Right.
And so the negative side is, well, I'm also a procrastinator, overly critical, judgmental, intolerant, and a rebel. And then the rubber met the road when I put it all together and I wrote, a gregarious, intolerant rebel, an intelligent, critical procrastinator, a compassionate, judgmental critic, a loving, intolerant man aware of others' needs. Wrote down, there was a war within me of these two opposing forces. And I think that you're pointing to this part of us, the confusion, this need for us to kind of hedge our bets. It's like, you know, you go play golf with somebody like, my elbow is a little sore. And it's like, what are you trying to say? It's like, so if you don't shoot a great score, is the elbow or what, we do these things. What is procrastination? Right. I mean, seriously, some of the most intelligent, like, what is that?
Yeah.
It's arguably a psychological hedge that we have that allows us to just say, gosh, we just leave it to the last minute purposefully. And yeah, that you can argue that there's ways that's part of it, that's genius and all that stuff. But the point of the book is to come to grips with the fact that I'm judgmental and I'm intolerant is a protective mechanism for this insecure little kid that would rather push you away. As long as I can put fault out there, as long as I could create that around me, well, it takes me off the hook for my own life. So all of those negative traits, one of the things that I really get into with clients is if we look at behavior that's quote unquote not serving you, the first thing I ask them is like, well, how is it actually working for you? How is it working for you? And a lot of times it'll be like, being intolerant, being judgmental, it keeps people at bay. It keeps them safe. It keeps them, they'll argue, well, I'm alone, I have relationships and I really want love in my life. Well, you kind of, whatever that wound is inside of you is being served by keeping people at bay.
Deep and so true. It keeps you from being hurt when you can be judgmental. Because by being judgmental, you place people in good guy and bad guy boxes. And so you don't expose your own vulnerabilities.
That's right. And here's the thing.
Yeah.
What's so, I think, confusing and so challenging is that even myself, with the utmost sincerity, I wanted to make a shift and I wanted to love my father. I really wanted a relationship with the utmost sincerity.
Right.
I wanted to be healthy and treat my body well. And yet every single time I started down the path, I would invariably fall off. And as soon as I fell off, it wasn't like, okay, just pick yourself back up again. I would then like this self-flagellating, and just the shame and the guilt would then kick in. And then that would become the new motivating force about feeling shameful and guilty and feeling so badly about that, as if that would make a difference by just beating myself up and then going back out there and doing it again. And then what? Invariably falling back off. And listen, it's arguable to say that this self-flagellating motivation, guilt, and shame approach to life can produce results. You can motivate yourself with that. But man, does it rob you of a life worth living. Yes. It really just tears apart the soul of the human being. And it's just an unnecessary part of life, just beating yourself up. And so again, rather than try to defeat this part of ourselves, build a new relationship with that part of you. Understand. The kids or the girls, they're going to want a hedge. Okay, I got it. No big deal. Keep going.
Yeah. What does being the kid look like?
Simple fear. I think that, it's that, think about a kid. It's like, it's me, me, me. It's taking everything personally. It's looking and imagining this world of monsters underneath the bed, participating in illusions about people liking them and not like them. We all do it. I mean, I sent the client a text message. I haven't heard anything back. And it's been an hour. I wonder if they're mad at me. Right away. What is that? Right? Or I've tried to do something. Oh, they don't want to care about the book. No, they don't care. No one cares about this stuff.
Fear of rejection.
Rejection. It's amazing how quickly our kids will conclude things that make no sense. And in the book, I say, it's just kid logic. There's nothing that would make that true. And it's so interesting. The more I talk about this, the more people will go dude, I had no idea. I do that all the time. Yeah. You see the little dots on the text thing coming and nothing said. You're like, well, wait, did they read it? They haven't said, well, and then they stop. You're like, wait, hold on. You left me hanging. And then the whole day you're wondering whether or not what you said. Well, did I say, maybe I should have said it.
What were those dots?
That's what it looks like. that's what it looks like in real life today for me. Yeah.
Real life knots. I love it. I love it. Oh my word. Knots. Or you're on social media. It's like, how come I didn't get a lot of likes on this post? Right? Am I not worthy? Do people hate me? Am I, you know, I'm not loved?
Well, and let's talk about that for a second, because lately I've seen a lot of these big course guys out there. There's a lot of people with social media influencer stuff, and they're talking about mental health, and it's great, right? They really are discussing this now today, I think more so than ever before. But the mental health aspect of it is, I think, rooted in the confusion of this identity. I'm so glad there are people like Brendon Burchard and some of these guys that are really standing for the good of being yourself, like this push for authenticity, this push for allowing someone to be exactly the way they are. But man, that's a confusing battle, because what gets likes and what doesn't get likes, and well, you know, authentic to get likes. And it's like transactional authenticity now that I'm seeing. Yeah. I'm like, holy cow, this has gotten lost. But I mean, I'll arguably say that I'm still suffering from, like, what's my social media? Do I want to get on every week and do a little update on the kid and the king? I don't know. There's some part of me that's resisting that. I take pictures of birds and, you know, mountains and, you know, but there is, you got to lean into what is it that is preventing your self-expression in the world to be okay. And if I can just tell one on myself, I think what I'm confronting right now is this need for significance of working with these high achievers versus putting together a little course on the emotional mastery process for anybody to use, right? That's why I wrote the book.
I love it. But
the confusion in there about, well, he works with people at these companies and, you know, these, you know, he's a big consultant, and there's confusion there, I think, still for me right now. And that's why I'm not maybe putting it out in the way maybe others are right now. Or it could just simply be, I'm on the journey there. I'm doing this. I'll tell you, 2 years ago, you wouldn't have caught me dead in front of the computer like this, and a video like this, talking to you like this, a mic like this, reading my own book out loud. So I think that my point is that we all are on this journey. It doesn't stop. Lean into whatever that edge is. I think you brought up such an important part of this, and that is we have these intentions, these ideas, and these things that we want to go do. And as we get older, we're more and more reluctant to leap out on that edge. And yet, wait a second, nothing that we've done in our life has ever been done before until we do it for the first time.
Absolutely. That voice of fear.
I mean, the first time I drove a car was the first time I drove a car. The first time I went on a date was the first time I did a presentation. Yeah. The first time I did anything was the first time. So the resources are here to do it. And yet our relationship to that edge has somehow gotten lost. And so the book ends with, before the last chapter, called The Conclusion, about the relationship with my father. It's literally about dancing on this edge, developing a new relationship. And I don't care who you are. I don't care how successful you are. I don't care how many followers, likes, degrees, wherever. We all have an edge of what we say we're okay with and where what stretching might look like over that. And instead of having the, oh my God, if I go over that edge, I'm going to fail and I'm going to look bad and then I'm going to kick in all of these kid-like logical thoughts, you just say, of course that's coming. Of course that's going to show up. And King's here and I got this.
Acknowledge it and move on.
There you go.
Acknowledge. I mean, we're not going to eradicate fear. We're not going to eradicate that inner voice. Mm-hmm. It's really unplugging ourselves from the matrix and to say that, yes, I acknowledge you fear. I acknowledge the potential failure. And I also acknowledge the fact that this fear may be rooted from an experience in my childhood that now makes no sense at all to have this fear. And so I'm going to just acknowledge you and then move on beyond you.
Yeah. And in the book, to get right into it, there is an exercise that will allow you for the first time to let all of those childhood experiences live as if they were experienced by the kid at that time. Allow it to show up and just say, like, of course, if my little kid I call Bobby comes to the table and comes to this discussion, it actually makes a lot of sense to me that he would be afraid. He wouldn't want to show up for this. He would want to start, you know, overcompensating or running away, fight, flight, or freeze in that situation based on this child's experience of life at that time. So allow it to exist. That's it.
Allow it, acknowledge it, appreciate it, and move on. Wow. Show us your book again. Show us, put the book up.
Here it is, right here.
The Kid and the King, Shasheen Shah, and you can get this on Amazon, I'm sure.
Yep, it's on Audible, it's on Kindle, and there's a paperback version.
So who reads it on Audible?
I do. I got to read it. That was one of the big things. It was like, you know, they told me, you know, I'll tell you, like a month before, and they're like, you have to read your own book. I'm like, God, I can't do that. I'm not going to read my book that well. Like, oh, I can't do it. I go, no, no, it'll take too long. And this was the great thing about, you know, when you're inside the jar, you need someone to look at it. Like, listen, get this mic, get this thing, forget about the sound baffling and all this other stuff. I got an audio engineer. Here's three people. Call them. They can do magic on the back end. This guy, Peter Lapinto, Lapinto Media, was a genius. He just said, Shasheen, just read. If you skip, just pause, breathe, reflect, do it again, reread. Right. I'll take care of it all on the back end. And I cannot tell you, I got it done in a week and a half. Wow. I had a ball doing it. And I'm happy with it. It sounds good. So if you can tolerate this voice, I'll talk to you on the book.
I'm an Audible guy. So I will be getting your book and listening to your voice.
Cool. Very cool. So
that's pretty awesome. Holy cow, where'd the hour go?
I don't know. But I got to cut you guys off because you're going for two more.
That was amazing. You should do your course.
Yeah, I'm really warming up to it. And, you know, there is a link in the book, and it's so funny, right? So in the book, it says, if you want more information, go to this place. And it's a hidden spot on my website that if you read the book and you go there, well, guess how many people have gone there? Not very many. So I've been waiting. So what did I conclude? I'm like, no one cares, right? But no, I will make it easier for people. Of course. To just at least walk through that five questions, the letter to your kid, the letter to your parents, going through the five questions of the emotional mastery process, all that will be online very shortly.
I'm getting your audiobook.
We care. Don't keep telling yourself nobody cares. We care.
But that's the kid, right? That's what it does. It just goes, no one cares. You know, yeah.
Okay, we got to continue this conversation. There's so much more to talk about.
All right, take us out, Dr. Trin. You two are like really into this. I can tell Dr. Trin relates to this. You know, he comes from that background, and A- is an F that strives to.
We got to bring that other doc in New York back and see what he says.
Yeah.
Remember the educator?
Yeah.
We got a John Hopkins educator who says, you got to get your A's because, you know, all the Asians are successful and they have all these things. We got to have you guys chat, man.
Well, I'll be like, yeah, and do this too. And we got a winner. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Thanks so much, Shasheen.
Pleasure to be with you guys.
Kid and the King, guys. Get it on Amazon. I'm getting it through audiobooks, so that's for sure. I love it. Take care now. We'll chat later.
Hey, guys. Happy holidays. Cheers.
Happy holidays.
Well, there you have it. Another great reason. You got to tune in each and every week to Health Talks here with Dr. Trin, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.